But when the time came to leave, she got in a taxi that took her straight home, not to the plaza. And Truman was none the wiser. Norman Mailer went around trying to start a fight all night long, first with McGeorge Bundy, then with George Plimpton, and then with anyone named George, then finally just anyone. Oh, how divine. I saw him and I thought, Norman, you've made my party. Although he wore that dirty raincoat the entire time. I doubt he even bathes. Do you? Only in the tears of his envy over you, true heart. Now tell me the truth. Slim arched an eyebrow, leaned back on the sofa of her hotel suite. Didn't Pamela look hideous? Absolutely. Completely stuffed like a goose, if you know what I mean. You looked fabulous, my pet. Simply fabulous. What a shame Kenneth couldn't come. What do you mean? I would have been bored to tears if my husband had been there. As it was, I had a wonderful time. I thought Gloria looked a little tight. Did she have some work done recently? No, Slim said while nodding. Of course not. Truman cackled. Big Mama, you're an absolute treasure. Babe looked wonderful, of course, as always. You know what I always say. Babe Paley has only one fault. She's perfect. Other than that, she's perfect. Isn't that the truth? But I love her, of course. So do I, more than anyone in the world, except for you, Big Mama. But wasn't it a fabulous party? It was a great party, True Heart. Really great. Have you seen the newspapers? Oh, those old things. Truman waved his hand dismissively, but his eyes gleamed. He looked a little puffy and tired this morning, Slim thought. But then, who didn't? She wouldn't even look in a mirror yet herself. But this morning, puffy and tired were badges of honor. Only those who had danced all night at Truman's party and looked it were in. Did Kay have a good time? The best. Tell me again. What was your favorite part?
When Tallulah Bankhead flashed her bush at Cecil Beaton, I thought poor Cecil was going to faint dead away.
Oh, that's precious. Too precious. I didn't see that. But it was grand, wasn't it, my dearest Big Mama? So grand. The grandest.
Truman kissed her and went on his way. Slim picked up the papers. She'd hidden the ones that were not so complimentary, the ones that more than hinted that it was just a little appalling that Truman had been able to give such a fabulous party because of the slaughter of a Kansas family, the ones that wondered if, now that he was such a social success, Truman would ever write anything good ever again. Truman had saved the best for last. He walked into the apartment, past the Picasso, and into Babe's open arms. She looked gorgeous, fresh, completely made up, and he marveled again at her discipline, her devotion to her best creation, her exquisite self.
Bobolink, my most precious person ever. Tell me all.
Oh, Truman, it was wonderful. And Babe said it quietly, seriously, with none of the exaggerated after-party brightness of the others. And maybe Truman registered that, and maybe he didn't.
It was, wasn't it?
He sighed, kicked off his shoes, and they both settled into a sofa, his head in her lap, his feet tickling a velvet pillow. She had tea waiting, and a special vase of lilies of the valley just for him. She'd known, hadn't she, that perfect creature, that simply everyone in the world would send him flowers this morning? Flowers and gifts and thank you notes and telegrams. So she'd saved her flowers, their flowers, the ones they sent to each other each time they suspected the other was a little blue, to give him in person. Babe was the most thoughtful person he knew.
Truman, I mean it. I haven't been to anything like it.
You did it. You were marvelous. And I'm privileged to have been there.
You stood out, of course. The envy of all. Slim and I were just talking about you. Were your ears burning? You, my dearest, were a rare flower in a sea of garishness. Not that everyone wasn't beautiful, they were. Although Slim, poor thing, what are we going to do with her? She has lost all her style, simply lost it.
I thought she looked lovely, Truman, Babe said, quietly admonishing. I heard you tell her so yourself.
Well, of course I did. It was the charitable thing to do. But you, my darling Babe, were singular. You always are.
You are so sweet to say so. But Babe flushed, and she ducked her head, and Truman squeezed her hand. Dozens of people a day told Babe Paley how beautiful she was, but she really believed it only when Truman did.
Now tell me everything, everything wonderful about last night. Tell me a story, Mama.
Truman closed his eyes, nestled deeper into her lap, and smiled in anticipation. And Babe, who had never read a goodnight story to her children when they were young, for she was always getting ready to go out or down to dinner when they were put to bed, and that took time, of course, time to array herself to perfection so that Bill might notice her, so that at least he would be proud to have her on his arm, took a deep breath and began. Once upon a time, there was a wonderful party. A beautiful fairyland of light and flowers and people, and one in particular, the most wonderful, the host. And soon Truman was asleep, and Babe was content. That aching pit in her belly filled with gratitude and purpose, and still she talked on in her low, soothing voice, spinning him a tale that weaved back and forth through time, from a chance meeting on an airplane long ago, vacations together, shared intimacies, secrets, fears and hopes and dreams, until last night and this morning and the future, and the two of them together, always, trusting, loving, for they only had each other, didn't they? Children grew up, grew beautiful, grew successful in their own right. But Truman would remain the same. He would love her, and allow her to love him. And so she told him other stories, stories she'd never told anyone else. All of them true, because Babe did not know how to lie. "I had an affair," she whispered. "But you knew that, didn't you? You guessed it long ago. It was only the once, because I couldn't stomach it. Yet Bill still sleeps with everyone but me, and I've told you that so many times before it's a broken record. But in its way, it's the truest thing of my life, the one thing I can count on. And can you believe it? I've grown to rely on it. I'm getting old, older, and so is Bill, so I don't think of leaving him anymore, because who would have me now? Where would I go? Who would have him? Getting older means having fewer choices, I've discovered. Not that I had that many when I was younger, but when I was younger, I knew my face. Now, when I look in a mirror, but when I look in your eyes, I still see myself. And that's what love is, isn't it? Truman. She looked down at him. His mouth was open, his pink cheeks slack as he snored softly. So she whispered, "And Truman, Bill can't hurt me anymore. My children can't either. But you could. You're the only person in my life with that power. I don't know how you could, but it's true. And I'm afraid of that. Only a little. I'm also happy because it means I do love you truly." And she smiled. Because to have Truman fall asleep on her lap was a gift, a precious gift. No one else could claim him like this. Babe knew he had made the rounds before coming to her. She knew it was his nature. Her approval wasn't enough. It would never be enough. One person's love never would be enough for him. And that was the difference between them. Because she needed only Truman's love. And he needed the world's. But still, hers was the lap he sought. Her embrace was where he fell asleep. And she cherished his trust, his childlike repose. For once in her life, Babe felt peaceful, unhurried. Bill's dinner could go unordered, the dressmaker who was supposed to mend her dress from last night uncalled, the masseuse who was scheduled ignored. Truman's party receded into the realm of make-believe. This moment was real. But more precious, more golden than any fairy tale. And outside, the world spun and spun, the elegant carousel of the 1950s and Camelot speeding up, wobbling on its machinery, threatening to become a psychedelic hurricane of change. But it didn't wake Truman up. Nothing could stir him from his dream.
Shh. Be quiet. Mama's here. Mama's back. Mama loves me best.
La Côte Basque, October 17th, 1975. The sun, said Slim, nibbling at an olive, is over the yardarm. Let's have a drink. The sun has almost set, Gloria retorted, and we've been drinking all day. What the hell is a yardarm, anyway? Slim laughed noiselessly, her shoulders shaking, her glasses askew.
What? Gloria scowled.
Pam was quiet, too quiet. Pickled, Slim decided, squinting, trying to get her into focus. Morella was mumbling to herself in Italian.
You have a yacht, Slim pointed at Gloria, gasping for air.
So? A yardarm is part of a boat, the beam or whatever at the bottom of the sail. You don't know that?
I employ people who do,
Gloria retorted icily, in an exaggeratedly British accent. Then she muttered under her breath,
Besami culo, puta.
What?
Nothing.
Papa used to say that, Slim mused dreamily. It was one of his favorite sayings, the sun is over the yardarm. It meant it was time to drink.
Oh, for God's sake, Slim, yes, we get it. You were Hemingway's muse, Papa's obsession, Papa's unfulfilled love. And CZ was Rivera's muse and Babe was Truman's.
Well, who the hell's muse was I? Gloria threw a napkin ring down on her plate hard, and everyone held her breath to see if the plate would shatter. It didn't.
Jesus Christ, Gloria, calm down. We don't want the Gestapo to arrive.
Oh, you would bring that up, wouldn't you? Wouldn't you? Gloria almost spat at Slim. She reared her lovely head back, tasted the saliva in her mouth, felt the Mexican blood finally fire up in her veins, pushing her to do what she'd spent a lifetime suppressing. Act, feel, love, live, hate, spit. Dios mio, spit at the puta's feet.
She felt Morella's hand on her arm, settling her down, being the princess that she was, calming her court.
Shh, Gloria, shh. We're not mad at each other,
Morella whispered, maddeningly reasonable. We're mad at Truman, remember?
Bastardo, pendejo, puto.
Somewhat mollified, Gloria swallowed, drank the brandy stinger Slim was handing her. Where did it come from? She hadn't ordered it. And lit another cigarette. The smoky haze over their table was epic, even for La Côte Basque. It was like the smog of Los Angeles these days,
the smoke from a forest fire, a monster from a horror film. But no one seemed to care. They all simply coughed, waved, and lit up again and again and again.
The ball, it was grand, though,
Pam mused softly.
Really, wasn't it? One of the last times. The last elegant times. It was,
Mirella agreed. It all went to hell after that, didn't it? Gloria asked rhetorically. Each now slightly tattered, lipstick was smeared, eyeliner runny, hairstyles melted, like ice cream on a summer day, Swan nodded.
What happened? What happened to the world? To Truman? To us?
Nixon. Nixon happened, Slim answered Gloria's question.
Vietnam, then Nixon, Mirella corrected.
Whatever, things changed. Our daughters became us, the beautiful ones, the socialites. Only they didn't want to be us, did they? Slim's voice was hoarse.
Just like we did not want to be our mothers,
Mirella pointed out.
But why not? We were better than our mothers. We are magnificent.
Gloria's voice was a cry of anguish, of loss, regret. Slim patted her hand and signaled for another brandy stinger.
We're old, Slim mumbled wearily. Goddamn old.
Truman made us feel younger, though, didn't he? For a while.
Then he left us.
Went off with that Studio 54 crowd, Liza and all. Started bringing around those terrible men. Remember the air conditioning man?
Oh, Christ.
I'd forgotten about him. Or I've tried to, anyway. Gloria cackled.
What was his name again?
Danny. Danny something. I've never understood that obsession Truman had for him. He was so stupid, that one. Muscular, but dumb as a rock. Out of his league. Remember when Truman brought him to Europe, took him to the best restaurant, and the poor slob was miserable, pining for hamburgers and baked potatoes? Yet Truman insisted this lug was the love of his life. He was just besotted and heartbroken when the lug finally had enough. That's when I just started not feeling right about Truman. I tried to be the same friend, but something was off with Truman then, don't you think? And it all started after the ball.
Slim handed Gloria her stinger. I've even felt sorry for him lately, with all this heartbreak. All these stupid men who keep taking from him and then leaving.
Gloria nodded.
Until now, that is. Yes, there were times he tore my heart. I know he wrenched babes, but he's crossed a line.
Crossed a line? Gloria gaped at Slim.
He murdered that woman. He as good as put those pills in her hand. And he aired the Paley's dirty laundry,
Pam reminded them all.
And one doesn't do that if one wants to remain, shall we say, intact.
He aired Bill Paley's stained dirty laundry if you want to get right down to it. Gloria mused. Stained bloody laundry, according to that story. How explicit Truman has gotten in his writing. He never used to be so vulgar. The other women nodded. Pam's cleavage was so exposed, Slim leaned over and tucked a napkin into it. For the sake of the children, dear.
Yet of course it was Bill who betrayed Babe in the first place, and who apparently told Truman all about it, just like a man. A foolish, vain man. Oh, why do we do it?
Gloria wailed.
Why do we put up with it, with these men?
These men we married when we were young and beautiful and desirable, even though they weren't.
Money,
Mirella and Slim answered simultaneously. Pam wrinkled her freckled nose. Talking of money was so crass, but so American. Yet, of course, they were right.
Why do you even ask? Slim added.
Because,
Oh, shit. Gloria shrugged. This was the reward, then. Married to an ugly old fart who gave her things, yes, but kept the really good jewels locked up, doling them out to her on occasions he deemed appropriate. The Guinnesses had houses, yachts, servants, the best clothes, but now nobody cared. Nobody looked at her twice in her Givenchy gowns, her Balenciaga suits. Because she was goddamn old, and she was stuck with a man who farted in bed, and she'd never get anyone else. There was no trading up, not anymore. And all she could look forward to was losing her teeth, more facelifts, orthopedic shoes instead of Ferragamos, the constant battle of the dye bottle. Dios mio, she couldn't go a week before the gray started to show now, at her hairline. And all the money in the world couldn't stop any of that. Couldn't stop the ravages of time and regret. And that was the secret. The wonder of Truman, she realized suddenly. Truman had made them forget all that. He had amused them. Their husbands didn't want to talk to them. They grew bored talking to one another, these glorious creatures, for they were all the same. Blonde, brunette, tall, short, European, or Californian, they were still the same. Only the exteriors were different. And they devoted their lives to maintaining this difference, striving to shine, be the one jewel who stood out. Yet at night, they took off the diamonds and gowns and went to empty beds, resigned to the fact that they were just women after all. Women with a shelf life. And then Truman leapt into their midst, and suddenly the gossip was more delicious, the amusements more diverse. He had sat on the beds of every one of his swans and whispered how beautiful she was, how precious, how devoted he was to her and her alone. And even though they all knew he was saying the same thing to each one of them, they didn't mind, because beneath the beauty, they were all so goddamned lonely. And the ball, that glorious black-and-white ball when they were so exquisite, so rare and coveted, that was their summit. Everyone's summit. New York's summit. Nobody dresses for lunch anymore, Gloria complained, looking around the room. Yes, ladies of a certain age, like them, still clung to dresses, hats, gloves, polished shoes. But women in pantsuits were now allowed to dine at La Côte Basque, the Colony, the Plaza. In less rarefied places, men and women both now regularly wore jeans, sometimes torn, and tennis shoes, and athletic shirts, in public. You know, the funny thing is that Danny, the air conditioning man, wouldn't have been invited to Truman's ball back then, mused Slim. God, we were all so beautiful, weren't we? The gowns, the masks. It seemed fun at the time. Just another day at the office, but now, I don't know. It seems like a lost dream, doesn't it? It's all lost. Truman giveth and Truman taketh away, muttered Gloria. And now he'll get away with murder. No, we taketh away. I'll bet anything the little shrimp has been phoning us all day long. Well, I gave my maid instructions to tell Mr. Capote that Lady Keith was unavailable indefinitely.
Yes, I did the same thing, Gloria nodded. So did Morella.
I wonder what he'll do without us, without her especially. He didn't know it, but he needed us, more than we needed him.
Slim?
Gloria raised her glass in a toast. That may be the most insightful thing I've heard from you all day. You're damn right. Come. Gloria set the glass down, signaled for the bill. Let's do something truly cruel. Let's go home and rest up, then dress. And all of us go out on the town together, as if there's nothing at all wrong, as if the bastard simply doesn't exist. I'll have my secretary call Susie Knickerbocker and Liz Smith and let them know. Of course, they'll tell Truman. That is one hell of an idea, Gloria. Slim reached for her purse. Except, well, it doesn't feel quite right without her. And once again, they all looked at the empty chair. Oh, it's not fair. Not her. We're all shits, all of us at this table. We've all done mean things to each other. We've all had our moments. Slim slumped back down. But Babe never did. She never said a bad thing about anyone, or did anything cruel or catty. Life isn't fair, Gloria reminded her briskly. We all know that. If life was fair, we'd be the ones with the fortunes, and our husbands would look like Paul Newman. Come on, we're doing this, I insist. We need some cheering up. And more importantly, we need to show that little shit we could give a fuck what he says or does. Or writes. Babe would understand. Yes, mamacita. Slim drew herself up, stifled a burp. Oh, I wish Papa were still here. We could take your plane and fly to Cuba. Wouldn't that be grand? Oh, for God's sake, stop it with the Hemingway crap. I'm not Truman, and I'm not that easily impressed. Gloria snapped, handing several $100 bills to the waiter. I think that's what I'll miss the most about him, Slim said, as the four ladies rose unsteadily to their feet. What? Truman. I'll miss having someone to tell my stories to. Say what you want about him. Truman was a very good listener. And a very good thief, remember? If it wasn't for us, he'd have nothing to write about. He stole our stories. He's a thief. And a murderer, in case you've forgotten. He's a storyteller. Slim shook her head. Just like Papa. Gloria cut her short with one flash of her dark eyes. The others followed, their heads held high, smiling at one and all. Stopping in the ladies' room to repair the damage of alcohol and time as best they could. Elbows out, powder flying, lipsticks wielded like daggers. Just in case there were photographers outside. There were. The familiar, loving click. The adored flash of bulbs, more intimate, more caressing than any kiss. The Reverend, Mrs. Guinness, look this way. Lady Keith, give us a smile. But then, a cold breeze blew past. Another door opened. A couple, the woman in a floppy hat, wide-legged trousers, the skinny man clad in a fur vest and striped pants, emerged, standing uncertainly on the sidewalk a few feet down. The photographers rushed away. Bianca! Mick! Mick Jagger! The swans were forgotten. Long live the king. Chapter 16. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. The Manhattan of the late 60s, early 70s. Well, actually, it was just the worst of times. After the ball is over, after the break of day. Did they know, the morning after Truman's party, that nothing would ever be the same again? No, they did not. Some claimed, later, that they did know it. That even as they were dancing, they felt a bit like Nero fiddling while Rome was burning. And some newspapers and magazines, in the days and weeks following the bash, did question the whole endeavor, likening it to Marie Antoinette during the Revolution. But in truth, when the glittering and gay left the ball, removed their dancing shoes, sent out their finery to be cleaned and repaired, or returned if they'd been gauche enough to have to borrow it, they simply reflected on what a grand time they'd had, and looked forward to more. But Manhattan, in the 60s and 70s, said, no, no dice. I'm turning on you, kid. strikes. Transit strikes, which Truman and his swans did not notice. Garbage strikes, which they did. Goodness, even on Fifth Avenue, the garbage piled and piled up to the sky. The air was fetid with filth, and when the winds swirled, garbage took to the skies like soiled, stinking confetti from a macabre ticker tape parade. No one could even go out on the streets without a perfumed handkerchief pressed to her face. Riots. After Martin Luther King Jr. was killed. What a nice man, really. A few had met him in Washington. Kay Graham was really upset by his death. Harlem erupted. Not that Babe or Gloria or Slim or Morella or Pam ever went to Harlem, mind you. But still, they could hear the sirens all night long. Nobody left her penthouse for fear of something. Then Bobby Kennedy and Truman cried and cried. Bobby had been a neighbor of his in the UN Plaza, and they'd had a couple of drinks together, although he'd always felt Bobby thought he was performing some kind of civic duty in befriending a homosexual. Still, he'd cried at his death, written poor Rose Kennedy a magnificent letter of solace, which he knew she would treasure forever if he did say so himself, and to anybody who would listen. Then Stonewall, and the village was suddenly crawling with drag queens and homosexuals, and surprisingly, Truman had little opinion about all this, even though Babe and Gloria and Slim and Morella and Pam all looked at him with great sympathy in those few days. But Truman went on as normal. Didn't feel compelled to go down and march with any of the other homosexuals or engage in kick lines in front of the police. And when they all asked him if he'd ever been to the Stonewall Inn, he wrinkled his nose and exclaimed, "God, no, that place?" And crime. Crime and dirt and filth. The hallmarks of Manhattan in the 60s and 70s. Of course, the swans and their consorts could flee, and they did, whenever possible. But still, they had to be in New York sometimes. Carry on the banner of good taste and social responsibility. There were still opening nights, benefits, galas to attend. But crime was right outside their door. Central Park was no longer safe at night. Not with all the muggings and beatings and knifings. Times Square. Oh, Times Square. For Slim, in particular, who had been part of Broadway's golden age, it was heartbreaking now to see the empty storefronts, hookers perched on stools on every corner, drug dealers lounging in doorways, cops on the beat, dirty, cheap stores that sold sex toys, inflatable dolls, plastic-looking lingerie. The people changed, too. No one had manners any longer. No one dressed. Those hippie young men did not hold the door open for ladies. Highballs were no longer the drug of choice. Pot and coke and LSD were the new amusements. A few of them did try LSD, at their therapist's urging. For a while, it was the thing to do. Go to a party, drop some acid, lie on velvet pillows staring at the ceiling, waiting to be told the secrets of the universe. But the next morning was always hell. And the ladies didn't like what it was doing to their skin, so they stopped. Truman didn't, however. Truman, in the years after In Cold Blood, the fabulous ball, the apex of his fame, grew puffier, less disciplined. Slept later, roamed pockets of the city he'd never roamed before, brought home men he'd never have looked at before. None of his swans ever figured out exactly what happened between him and Jack. They only knew that the relationship no longer involved sex. Truman was more than happy to let them know that anyway. And they all found, to their surprise, that they missed Jack. That gruff, humorless, rude to the point of insanity man. After all, he'd once told Lowell Guinness that he was a Nazi. And while everyone knew this to be true of both Guinnesses, no one had ever said it to their faces. But they all recognized the steady, no-nonsense influence Jack had had on Truman. He was the ballast to Truman's airy sails. While they were still somehow in each other's lives, they still took vacations together, to Verbier, Switzerland, to their twin houses on Long Island. It wasn't the same as before. Truman was different because of it. More unstable. Some said untrustworthy, at least when they were outside of Babe's hearing. But Gloria and Babe and Morella and Slim and Pam weren't any different. They held on, clung to their disciplined lives, their shared belief that sophistication and elegance counted for something, counted for everything in their world. Their clothes might have changed some. Gloria was one of the first to introduce the Pucci pantsuit into society, and Babe's skirts grew imperceptibly shorter. They all flocked to Halston, their former millinery magician at Bergdorf's, when he opened his own salon and introduced long, flowing, caftan-like dresses made of jersey, sometimes one-shouldered, sometimes halter-backed. Still tasteful, but smacking slightly of the younger fashions. They clung to their former hairstyles with strange devotion. If their skirts were looser, no longer requiring girdles, although of course they still wore them, then their hair remained rigid, unyielding. Not for them the long, stringy styles of the flower children, or the precision boy cuts introduced by Vidal Sassoon. They still looked forward to their twice-weekly visits to Kenneth's. Depended on them, really. Found refuge in the soothing music. Teacups, champagne flutes, stylists still clad in the suits and ties that Kenneth himself wore. They were pampered, but more important, they were prized still. In the reliable townhouse in which few young women would be seen, the Babes and Morellas and Glorias of Manhattan still found themselves desired and desirable. And so they retained the kind of hairstyles that required setting, hairspray, sleeping in a hair net or curlers every night. Hairstyles that, unlike the rest of Manhattan, were impervious to the winds of change. But Truman, oh, Truman, how he changed. How he adopted the fashions tragically of the youth movement. He never wore love beads, but good God, those caftan-like suits he wore, the Nehru jackets, the feuds he got into. Of course, he and Gore Vidal had never liked each other, but now they were actually engaged in a lawsuit. Truman repeating a story he insisted that Gore had told him of Bobby Kennedy decking Gore in the White House. Gore was suing for libel. And he'd always had a love-hate relationship with Norman Mailer, which devolved into hatred pure and true when Mailer won the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Award for The Armies of the Night, awards that Truman hadn't won for In Cold Blood. So Truman accused Mailer of ripping him off, of doing what Capote had done first, and more brilliantly, of writing another non-fiction novel. And the things he'd said about Jackie Suzanne. That The Valley of the Dolls author was a truck driver in drag. Even if he had a point, it was a vicious thing to say, especially on The Tonight Show. Truman, on The Tonight Show, talking to Johnny Carson on the West Coast, Dick Cavett on the East. Truman had gone Hollywood, of all things. Truman had gone global. He was everywhere and nowhere, peripatetic. He was in Rome, he was in Switzerland, he was in Palm Springs, he was in Venice. He was on the cover of Time, he was writing articles for Rolling Stone, he was dropping acid with The Who. What he wasn't doing, as far as anyone could tell, was writing his next book. "So what are you writing next?" asked Johnny, asked Dick, asked the world. "It's brilliant. My masterpiece, called Answered Prayers, after that saying by St. Teresa of Avila. There are more tears shed over answered prayers than unanswered ones. Isn't that brilliant? It's going to be a darkly comic observation of society, real society.
I've had a first-class seat to it all, and darlings, the things I've seen. I'm a modern-day Proust.
When will you be done?
Oh, soon, soon. It's all up here.
Truman tapped his now bald head, wrung his fat little hands dripping with rings, twisted up his baby-soft lips in a smirk, shifted his caftan-clad lard about in the chair.
I've spent years observing this world. Years.
Curled up in an overstuffed armchair, an empty ebony cigarette holder in her hand, Babe eyed Truman on the television screen. Her hands itched to fill the holder with a cigarette and light up. But she swallowed, breathed as deeply as she could, and took a sip of water, chewing resolutely on an ice cube instead. When she set the crystal glass back down on its coaster, however, she missed. The glass hit the tabletop with a loud crack, and water spilled everywhere. Babe gasped and let out a small cry.
What? What is it, Babe?
Instantly, Bill was by her side, kneeling on the floor, looking up into her face. She grimaced and laughed.
Nothing. I just made a little mess, that's all.
Oh. Bill looked relieved. He ran his hand through his very thin, very silver hair and exhaled.
I thought, well, never mind. I'll get a towel.
He turned to see what was on the television.
Truman? What's he up to tonight?
Oh, the same thing, I'm afraid. He's wasting his talent. Still talking about that book of his. Bill, do you think he's written a single word of it?
No, I don't. He talks a good game, but he lacks discipline. He didn't used to. It's really a damn shame.
Yes, it is.
Babe turned back to gaze at the television screen. Now Truman was repeating an oft-told story, one that she'd laughed at many times, along with all her friends.
Well, he drawled, his voice even higher, more exaggeratedly fey.
She'd noticed this lately, how he seemed intent on becoming a caricature comprised of his most studiously affected elements. The lisp, the drawl, the limp wrists. Back when she first met him, these had simply been part of a more sharply etched, richly detailed picture. Now he was a walking, mincing Hirschfeld cartoon.
Well,
he continued, shifting in his chair on the garishly loud Tonight Show set, looking up at the ceiling, as he always did whenever he was about to tell a whopper, as he so endearingly put it.
I was at this restaurant, minding my own business, when a woman came over and asked me for my autograph. I said, of course. But what did she want me to sign? She proceeded to expose her breasts.
And here Truman paused, rolled his eyes, and allowed Johnny Carson to lead the audience in knowing laughter.
I know! Anyway, I signed it. I mean, why not?
More laughter.
But then her husband, who was fuming, came over. And he whipped out his thing and said, sign this. And I looked down and said, well, I don't see how, but maybe I can initial it.
The audience was rolling in the aisles. Johnny Carson was beet red, laughing so hard there were tears in his eyes. Babe and Bill exchanged a look.
He told it better the first time I heard it, Bill said.
It's so crude.
Babe shook her head, switching off the television with the remote. I don't know why he has to be so vulgar.
He's always been, to a certain extent, except around you.
Yes, but there was a line he wouldn't cross. Lately, however, oh, those men. Babe shuddered, thinking of the parade of truck drivers, bankers, and air-conditioning repairmen he brought to Kailuna, uninvited, just the way he used to bring Jack. But Jack, despite his gruffness, was a decent man, interesting and so obviously in love with Truman. These men, this latest particularly, John O'Shea, actually a banker, a middle-class banker who berated Truman, put him down, told anyone who would listen how lousy he was in bed. Babe simply didn't know what to think, what to do. She couldn't very well ask them to leave, so she did what she always did. She smiled, was polite, interested, fed them, made sure they were well taken care of under her roof, and then let Truman cry on her shoulder when they left, his heart broken every single day, every single minute, it seemed. Dan had been mean to him, called him a fag, left to go back to some horrid woman. Bob had told him he was awful in bed. John had told him he was a hack. "I don't know what to do for him," she whispered. She glanced at the table next to her, cluttered with amber prescription bottles, and sighed. "If something happens to me, who will take care of Truman?"
"Nothing is going to happen to you," Bill said too quickly. "You're getting the best care possible. The doctor said if you quit smoking, you'd live a long life, and I'm going to make sure you do."
Babe smiled. She adjusted her wig, for even now she wouldn't let Bill see her at less than her best. But something had broken inside her. The day the doctor told her it was cancer, this thing that was squeezing the air from her lungs, taxing her energy, causing her feverish dreams, making every step seem as if she were climbing a mountain. Something had come tumbling down, releasing all the fetid ugliness she'd spent a lifetime stifling. Babe could put into words feelings and emotions that she'd never been able to before. All the books Truman had made her read, none of that had given her the vocabulary the simple diagnosis of malignancy had.
"Let's get you into bed now,"
Bill said, reaching down to help her out of the chair. "Leave me alone," Babe snapped. "I'm perfectly capable of that."
"Would you like me to sleep in here tonight, just in case you need anything?"
"Interesting that you offer this now, when I could give a shit about sex."
Bill bit his lip, accepted his wife's wrath, and watched her walk tremulously but defiantly into the bathroom, head held high. She closed the door in his face. Something had broken inside William S. Paley, too, that terrible day at Mount Sinai, when the most famous cancer doctor in the world had sat the two of them down and given him his diagnosis. Shock. Pure shock. That this could happen to him. To Babe, that is. To Babe. No, God damn it, to him. He was older than Babe. A lot older. Older than he told people. When she was diagnosed back in January of 1974, and a third of her lung removed, he was 72 to Babe's 58. Bill Paley, despite his lifetime hypochondria, had never been a man who thought about death, his own, anyway. Still, he'd never imagined he'd have to grow old alone. He'd never imagined that Babe would not be there to take care of everything, as she always had. He'd never imagined that he'd have to start looking back on his past actions with regret, remorse, shame, even, because his beautiful wife might be dying. When they left the doctor's office, they'd gone straight to their apartment on Fifth Avenue. Babe had gone to her room to rest. Truman was the first of her friends she called. She must have rung him before she lay down, because Bill, still in his study, his head in his hands, an untouched glass of scotch in front of him, was stunned to see a pale Truman, tears streaming down his cheeks, standing next to him, putting his arms around him, comforting him like he'd never been comforted in his life. I had to come to you first, Truman whispered, rocking the bigger man back and forth, even though Bill wasn't crying. I know Babe is strong, but you, my dear friend, you're the one who will have the hardest time figuring out what to do next. And Bill had to admit that Truman was right. Babe was strong. She'd know how to handle this crisis with the same grace and beauty and guarded privacy with which she'd handled everything else. But Bill absolutely didn't know what to do when faced with a foe that money couldn't vanquish, or a life without someone to see to his every need, a life without Babe, whom he had wronged so many times. I'm such a bastard, he'd told Truman that afternoon, so eager to find absolution for his sins he spilled them all. You don't know how big a bastard I am. I've screwed everyone, right here in our apartment, in all our beds, in all our homes. I never thought about Babe at all. I wanted what I wanted, and I took it. God, one time I was sure she'd find out because the woman, well, she left a mess. Blood. You know, that time of the month. And Babe was due home. It was back when we had that place at the St. Regis, and I couldn't send the laundry out and get it back in time, so I scrubbed that stain. Scrubbed it like I was Lady fucking Macbeth. I didn't have any way to dry the sheets, so I baked them in the oven until I could put them on the bed, still wet. And then I fell asleep. And do you know, Babe never once disturbed me. I woke up to find she wasn't even there. She'd come home and found me asleep on the damp sheets, thought I had a fever or something, and left a note saying she'd gone on to Kelowna so she wouldn't bother me. I'm such a bastard. A lousy bastard. And now she's sick. And it's what I deserve, but it's not what she deserves. No, it's not. Truman's voice was hard, and Bill looked up into blue eyes that were not wide with obsequious approval, as they always had been. Now Truman's eyes were like chips of ice, and Bill actually shivered. You're a goddamn bastard, Bill. I like you. I've always liked you, but I've never liked the way you treated Babe. But I'm not going to make this harder on you now. It looks like you're doing that yourself. And besides, you need to stop sniveling and be there for her. She deserves that, at least. I know. Bill shrugged Truman's arms off his shoulders, got up, and poured him a drink. His hands were shaking as he grabbed the tongs, filled the glass with ice. Both men relaxed at the blessed clink, clink of ice against glass. Once the drink was in Truman's hands, they each exhaled. How is she? Truman asked, after taking a greedy gulp. Quiet. She didn't say a word on the drive home. What did she say to you?
She said, please come. It's cancer.
That's all. So go. Go to her. I know she needs you. You're better for her than I am. You always have been. And God knows if I understand why, but I don't care right now. Truman finished his drink, set the glass down on a mahogany table.
I'm better for her because I love her.
So do I, Bill whispered. Funny how it takes something like this to remind you.
Funny how it shouldn't.
And Truman left Bill, strode through the fabulous duplex, for once not pausing to gape and admire the magnificent furniture, the crystal chandeliers, the precious objets, grouped like still lifes on the polished furniture. What did any of it matter to the Paleys now? Except to provide Babe with a fabulous setting in which to be sick. Perhaps die.
Truman knocked on Babe's door that awful afternoon. Softly. For the first time ever, not sure of his reception. And he was terrified. He was ashamed to admit. Terrified of what, who, she might become. Would this ruin her beauty, this awful thing that was eating away inside? And then he hated himself for thinking that, but he was honest enough to admit that that was Babe's greatest appeal, even now, after decades of friendship and intimacy and confession. She was simply so lovely, so restful to look at. And Truman did love beauty so. "Come in," she said, sounding like herself. And so he did. Babe was pacing around her fabulous room, all vivid oriental fabric on the walls, the curtains, the spread. Priceless paintings hung on her walls, yet this was the room in the house that felt the least like a museum. She had made it personal with framed photos, so many of just the two of them. Truman and Babe in happier times. Silly little knick-knacks from dime stores, mixed with exquisite antiques from Third Avenue. That old white paper flower, now encased in glass, as if it were from Tiffany's and not a market in Jamaica. Truman recognized it, and tears scalded his eyes, tears he hastily blinked away before Babe could see. "Well, it's cancer," Babe said bluntly, no self-pity in her husky voice. "Cancer. They're going to remove part of my lung."
"Oh, Bobolink."
"I have to stop smoking." But her hands were reaching to light one up even as she spoke. She did so, taking a defiant drag. Then she stabbed it out viciously after only one puff. "My last one." She opened a gold filigree casket full of her L&M brand cigarettes, raised a window, letting in the city sounds of cars honking, brakes squealing, the far-off wail of a police siren, and dumped the contents out. Cigarettes spun through the air. Then she slammed the window shut.
"Oh,"
she said, looking suddenly stricken, "I should have saved those for the help. That was wasteful."
"Babe."
Truman held out his arms, walking to her, but she refused to run into them. She was paler than usual, but other than that she looked like herself, only livelier, more vivid, as if the painting had finally come to life.
"No, no, I'm fine. Really. I'm not afraid. I'm just angry. Angry at myself for somehow allowing this to happen. Angry at the damn cigarettes. Angry at Bill, to tell the truth. Although I really don't know why."
"Yes, you do."
"Yes, I do. Of course. You know that. How is he? I assume you saw him just now."
"He's a mess. Very remorseful, if you want to know. Very afraid for you."
"I doubt that will keep his dick in his pants." Babe's hand flew to her mouth. Her eyes grew wide. And then she giggled. So did Truman. And then the two of them were seated in a chaise longue, entwined, her head on his chest. Strange, she thought, as she appreciated his surprisingly strong arms about her. How it always was the other way around. Except for that one night, that precious night when she'd bared herself to him. She was always the comforter, even as he was always her confessor.
"You'll be fine," Truman soothed.
"I might not be."
"No, you might not. But still, you don't know that. You don't know anything right now."
Do you know what I keep thinking? I keep thinking that I'll only be remembered as the woman who tied a goddamn scarf around her handbag one day.